Right. So, so what I've done with the book is for each person, I've done sort of biographical details, yeah. and then I've tried to select an area which I think would be of particular interest to Oxford. So I thought if you're happy, we could talk about the Institute of Molecular Medicine. Mm-hmm. But first of all, sort of, what made you interested in haematology?
Oh, pure chance, really. I had to. I was one of the last to have to do national service after the they used to let doctors finish their clinical training and then do their national service. And for some reason, I think they lost my address, so I didn't kind of get the usual call up after joining the house job. Yeah, so I thought, well, a bit pompous to ring them up and remind them. So I took an SHO job, a senior house officer job in Liverpool, and decided I'd have a go at the membership. And they then did catch up with me, joined after about 6 months, and they said I could have one go at the membership, and then I must join the army. I got the membership on the way to my first evening in the army. And then I volunteered to do my national service in the UK because I'm terrified of flying and insects and snakes. And so they sent me to Singapore. Typical army, because they'd had no experience in pediatrics, they were in deep trouble. They had this huge pediatric ward in the military hospital and looked after all the kids of diverse Commonwealth forces and the Gurkhas and all that. The war was going on in Malaysia at the time, or Malaya as it was then. They asked me to look after the children's ward for the first year out there. So, and I bumped into a child with what turned out to be thalassemia afterwards. And that really switched me on to an interest in genetics and blood disease. So I went off and got a bit of training in America straight after the army. I kept a kind of foot in general medicine. I mean, I would be unemployable now.
Where did you go in the States?
I went to Johns Hopkins. Liverpool had a kind of connection because Cyril Clark, who was the professor of medicine in Liverpool, and had been one of the first after the Second World War to realise that he went into genetics because of his hobby, which was breeding butterflies, and then set up a genetics setup in Liverpool and started a kind of bit of a partnership with Johns Hopkins, with Victor McCusick, the famous guy at Hopkins who's one of the founders of medical genetics. So I went over to Hopkins and spent nearly 4 years there, a couple of years in genetics, and then a couple of years in hematology, and with also a part-time appointment in biophysics, a place where I was trying to learn some protein chemistry and that was it. So,
what did you think of Johns Hopkins? Because I'm interested because of my own connection, because he was one of the founders of the Johns Hopkins.
Yeah. Well, Hopkins was, of course, the first modern medical school, really. I mean, it was the model that Flexner based all his reforms at the medical schools in the States. Largely because I think the founder had spent time in Germany, and where they had these already got these kind of this strong basic science-based in medical education and training, and it was in the late 50s, early 60s, it was very good. It was a bit like Oxford, though, extremely self-satisfied and a little bit inward-looking, and probably at that time not as great as it had been. They'd had these great figures like, you know, Blaylock and Taussig with the first kind of heart operation, congenital heart operations and that kind of thing, and then Osler himself. The founders of those early departments were all big names in America. And then it had this swing back in the 60s. I think it's now probably one of the top medical schools in the States. I don't know, I'm on the external review board for Harvard Medical School, and I was there last week reviewing them. A couple of people from Hopkins were there. I think it's going very strong. But it was a funny mixture in the 60s, early 60s.
A funny mixture of clinical and science and various people being not, sort of tacked together.
And being rather over kind of, rather overstating it's kind of the level of its research, certainly. And its clinical teaching was a bit patchy as well. The best clinical teachers were the guys who came in, had kind of rights in the hospital, they were in the private sector, one or two superb teachers. The clinical, the research side had slipped, I think. Then it got a big rejuvenation in the late 60s, and it was extremely strong.
I was going to ask you, who's your most memorable patient? Would it be the child with the thalassemia that you...
We knew that there were going to be no facilities for her anywhere near the transfusion and that. And she wasn't going to survive very long. And then they had this wonderful picture of her with Lady Mountbatten with her arm around her, and then Lady Mountbatten being straight off and dropped dead in Borneo. So Lord Mountbatten, there's a wonderful, this picture was taken by a local press photographer. And Mountbatten saw it, and because it was the last photograph of his wife, he had a local Indian artist make a big old drawing of it. And then there was a story of this appeared in the press many years later, completely wrong, all about this girl with leukemia. And so I wrote to Mountbatten and told him the story. Really, very nice letter back. That was just before the IRA blew him up. But I got a They sent me a copy of the picture recently because I was writing a small history of thalassemia, and it's a beautiful picture. So I suppose she was the patient that started me off in that research field.
Of all the things you've done in your career, what are you most proud of?
I don't know.
This place, perhaps?
This place? Yeah, I think this has gone quite well. Probably this place and what we've done in latter years in setting up all these partnerships with the developing countries, partly, I mean, in my own field, and then we started these partnerships, of course, in 1979, I guess, these broader partnerships with places like Thailand and and I think they've been very, very successful. Quite a good model for the most economic way to help the developing country.
Right, yes.
So something like that.
And then, yes, I was going to ask you about the Oxford Textbook of Medicine.
Oh dear.
How did that come about?
Well, it came about. That is a vivid memory because I'd only been in Oxford about 2 weeks. And then that strange secretary, I had to be careful, I'd inherited from my predecessor, came in the office at the old Radcliffe one morning and said, "There's a young man wants to see you. You better see him quickly because you think he's been in tears." I thought it was a bit odd because coming from Liverpool, males in tears is pretty unusual phenomenon. Anyway, he did look a bit depressed, this guy, and he was Oxford University Press staff member. I don't know exactly what he was one of the editors anyway, and he said that they'd just published, I think it was the 13th edition of their great classic textbook, Price's Textbook of Medicine, and it had come out to rather lukewarm reviews, to put it mildly. It's so funny actually, because he banged some of these reviews on the desk, and the first review was in the Annals of Internal Medicine, an American journal, and this was a review that said, "When I opened this textbook, I noticed that the senior editor was the physician to Her Majesty the Queen. Having read the book, my only thought would be, God save the Queen." And the reviews are all about that level. And it was quite clear that this was not going to be a bestseller, so he said that they desperately needed a new textbook, and I don't know, I was stupid enough to I talked to John Ledding, and the only idea that attracted me was that if we could produce a textbook in medicine that was much more global in coverage rather than the kind of standard Western textbook. And so we got hold of David Worrell, because he already had a lot of tropical experience, and the three of us did it. But I think it was, the question of whether there's a place for general textbooks. I think some of the other reviews of the may have been the first edition of the Oxford textbook, or what, Price certainly tapped Tony Mitchell in, who went as the first professor of medicine in Nottingham. He said textbooks were like dinosaurs. I think his biological knowledge of the kind of demise of dinosaurs is a bit faulty, because he said that they died because they fell under their own weight, which is not exactly what happened as far as I know. But and these books would do exactly the same. And there was no place really for books of that type anymore. But I always thought there was, really, because I think if you're practicing any specialty in medicine, you do need a general guide. Anyway, it went okay, and it's still going. A lot of it, they're revising it online mainly now, I think, aren't they? I got an email from them just this week saying they were thinking of revising a lot of the chapters for the online version anyway.
It has had an international appeal, I'm sure, because students who go on electives say that it's the one thing often that's there available to refer to. So I think it has, in practice, disseminated hugely.
The big problem is cost. In the first two editions, I think, they had this... the British government had this... part of a kind of aid system was a system whereby one could get books printed for a reduced price for dissemination in the poorer countries. That program finished. So I think we got two, perhaps the first and second edition had done that way, but after that it finished. And it's very difficult now, because we wrote this, what was the major textbook, I think, on thalassemia. The fourth edition of that came out in 2001. When I went back a couple of years ago to what was then Blackwell's, discussed a fifth edition. And I said I would only do it if they would produce a cheaper copy for the developing countries, because that's where it's needed. And they very kindly told me they would only do that if I paid them 80,000. So I'm still thinking about it.
Yes.
It's very difficult.
I've got a copy of your book, and I've also got Osler's sixth edition, which is the 1906 one, and I find it fascinating to see, obviously, what things they cover. And in Osler, there are pages and pages on TB, which seems to be the thing this most of it is.
In Osler?
Yes, yes.
You've got the original, because, of course, the Johns Hopkins people reissued that, and they've updated it from the
right. Yes, yes.
I haven't seen a copy of that recently. But they did it. McGee Harvey did it, I think, and a couple of others.
Now, I was going to ask you about your Royal Society leaving do about the money for the hospital in Sri Lanka. Was it instead of your retirement party?
Oh, it wasn't the Royal Society.
Oh, was
it? No. I was a trustee of the Wellcome Trust for about 10 years. And when you finished at the Wellcome, they gave you a rather splendid dinner. And I think Michael Dexter was the... was the director of the Wellcome at the time, and I said to him that I didn't want to do a leaving party. I wanted, but if they could give me a bit of money towards building this treatment centre for the kids in Sri Lanka, so they gave me How much did they give me? No, it was a few hundred pounds anyway, and you can do a lot in Sri Lanka for that. So I found a retired architect in Colombo, a British architect, who said he would do it for nothing, and so with the welcome money and that, we got it off the ground.
Mm.
But it was the welcome.
Oh, right, yes.
Just forgotten how much money it was. I mean, obviously, missed a damn good dinner. But, it was a few thousand.
Right, yes.
And you still go back to Sri Lanka quite often?
Yeah. I'm going back in the... I, on average, I've gone about four times a year. It started really by chance, because I was giving a lecture there, and they most really just let these kids die. And there was a pediatrician, woman pediatrician, who tried to set up a bit of treatment for them up in the place in the middle of the island called Kurunegla. That in Kurunegla state has the highest frequency of the disease, and she asked me to go and sort them out, and so we brought a lot of samples back to Oxford to find out what type of disease it was, and somehow from then I started going. At first it was awful because they had no facilities in there. The kids used to come in for transfusion and there was nowhere for their mothers, and they used to lie on the floor. They couldn't get the blood ready, so they had to spend the night being transfused. And, it was clear that there was a big patient population, obviously, so thought we'd better try to build something for them. So we built this three-story place with the first floor for the very young and then the second floor for the older patients. I think there were quite a lot of older patients with the disease, and it's a very complicated setup because there's so many different forms of it, and a lot of different forms, even in Sri Lanka. And then and then we trained a boy here who did his PhD with me, but I made him do the PhD on the Sri Lankan disease problems. And then he went back and managed to get another British donor to give us some money to build up a diagnostic centre for them, a DNA diagnostic centre there, not just for thalassemia, but for infectious disease as well, particularly. So they've got a big dengue centre. And then gradually worked up a kind of national programme and screening programme and all that kind of thing. It's been pretty slow. And then with the war, there were places we couldn't go to. But now we've just done a complete survey of the island. We've got 27 centres on the island with about 7,000 children. Because amazingly, the disease is, even on that relatively small island, it's very patchy in distribution. And so just checking one area, it gives you no idea of the total. But no, it has been rather slow, actually.
Do you think, is the life expectancy improving?
Oh, yeah.
It is, yes.
Very much so.
Mm.
And that's why my big problem there has been that they have a kind of unionistic division. A child becomes an adult. But it's 14. Yeah, there must be no overlap.
Mm.
The unions don't like it.
Mm.
And so training pediatricians was okay, but there's nobody to look after the children. And it's been a huge problem getting they have based on the British system, you know, they have these kind of colleges. They have colleges of everything. College of even not don't have a college of pathology. They have a college of hematology and a college of microbiology has 5 members, and hematology about 12. But bloody colleges are not very effective. Just had a breakthrough with they've agreed they must get adults trained to look after those kids as well.
So there's quite a lot of political treacle to wade through.
Oh, God, yeah, it's terrible. Jealousies and all that kind of thing. Usual thing, but probably if you imagine somebody from Sri Lanka coming in and telling you how to run your place, you yeah, it's only natural, I think.
Things like cord blood transfusion and bone marrow transplants, is that used much?
Well, no, it's used a lot in many countries now, particularly marrow transplants, if there's a compatible donor, have been fairly successful. But they've not got a transplant set up yet in Sri Lanka. There's been a lot of talk about it, but some of the other places I've worked and done a lot of training, in Thailand, for example, there's a huge problem. They have to just fairly recently developed a modest marrow transplant program. And certainly in India, there's a very good program, a couple of very good programs in India now, but it's been a bit slow getting off the ground, and it's only valuable if they do have a donor. And by and large, they are really much more successful if done early in life. The results decline quite dramatically in the older patients. So it's not the answer yet.
No. And what do you think will be the sort of future developments with thalassemia?
Well, probably like a lot of single gene disorders, I think I'm fairly confident now that gene therapy will be successful. It's been incredibly slow. There has been one successful, let me rephrase that. There's been one case where there's been the donor hemoglobin has been produced for at least a year in a child, but it's a funny case and some odd things about it. But my guess is, because the French had got that system going quite well for one of the genetic immune diseases, and then of course they've got this outbreak of leukemia, and the kids had been treated, and they found that this gene they'd put in had kind of homed in right next to a kind of oncogene. But they did a very good job in sorting that out, and I think the recent genes that are being put in and now got kind of fail-safe regions around them, which would make it very unlikely that they would affect genes close to them.
Right. Yeah.
But
yes.
I think the technical details were grossly underplayed, actually, and but it'll happen. It's just. There's another big trial going, starting early this year, from a group in New York. but it's I think people have grossly underestimated the kind of complexity of sticking genes into people. It's been something in your area, hasn't there, really, in the
retinal pigmentation.
Yeah.
Yes.
And looking quite promising, I think.
Yes, and I suppose because the eye is relative enclave,
you can
also test it relatively easily to see. Hematology would lend itself pretty well to that, knowing whether you've got success even for a period, I guess, because of the ability to sample in
the eye. Yeah, because you can get at the same as the eye, really. It's not like having to put something in the liver and or muscle or something like that.
But there must be an inherent tension between having a disease that's common in less developed parts of the world and having the technology to do things like bone marrow transplants or gene therapy in a much safer environment if you've got the resources to use there for safety. And it must be a big problem of knowing how far to push things at a level.
Yeah.
And units such as yours must bridge that gap to a certain extent.
Well, we have to, that's why in a lot of places we've really focused on prenatal diagnosis, and because of just simply the cost effectiveness of it, and the fact that it does give the family, if they wish, the kind of certainty of having a normal child.
It must be a huge burden on the family to have not only one child but several children who are affected.
Yeah, that's been one of the tragedies in Sri Lanka, for example. Mm. First of all, however much you do genetic counselling, you cannot persuade a Sri Lankan male that there's an abnormal child, any part of him. It's always the woman's fault. And so the families tend to break up, and we've got very high suicide rate in these families. And the counselling is absolutely critical, actually, and because they've got very few trained counsellors. So that's been quite a big part of our effort in trying to improve the kind of social background of this disease. And then in Sri Lanka, they've not allowed prenatal diagnosis yet. It's interesting. The Theravada Buddhists, by and large, have accepted it in Thailand. It's the same brand of Buddhism, but they say not in Sri Lanka, but I think what's happened in Sri Lanka is the Buddhists have been a bit uncertain, and the major Christian religion in Sri Lanka is Catholicism, and they've pushed very hard against it. So it's still not, but it's now developed in most countries in Asia. And huge effect on the numbers in places like in the Middle East and Iran and places like that. Mm-hmm. The Muslim religion accepted it much earlier. Fascinating to talk to these people. I've been to several ethics committee meetings in the Middle East, listening to the Islamic view of how a fetus develops, which is fantastic, beautifully illustrated, totally incorrect, of course. But they believe that the soul enters the fetus at about 14 weeks, called the breathing of the soul. And if you go in before then, and it's for the benefit of the family, then there's no objection.
What about any changes in the medical school while you've been Regis? or anything interesting happened or anything?
I don't know. My overall view is that when I first came to Oxford, the clinical side of the Department of Medicine was really quite strong. My predecessor had encouraged good clinical practice. Well, both predecessors, I guess. And it was perhaps a little bit thin in numbers, but quite strong on the clinical side. And then I was lucky enough to have a readership slot before I even got here, and appointed John Leddingham, who was a very strong clinical teacher. And what seemed to me to be rather thin was the research side. So I think we started building that up and got one or two really excellent people in different fields, apart from my own field. And then the MRC came along and offered me a unit, MRC unit, and it soon became apparent that medical research was going to take on this kind of more cellular and molecular, or a lot of it was anyway, and there was nowhere in the... And people in the medical school were constantly coming to us for kind of borrow equipment, or it was quite clear that there was a need for somewhere where young clinicians could get trained in this kind of technology, and also a place where young PhD scientists who wanted to practice and then practice for their research to be in the medical direction, there was nowhere for them either. So that's why eventually we went to the MRC and suggested what this building was originally set up for a chap called Jeffrey Dawes, who was a fetal physiologist and worked with sheep.
Mm-hmm.
And it was extraordinary when I first came to Oxford. I don't know if you remember that. This place was like a sheep farm, isn't it?
Bleating noises.
Bleating noises, that's right.
And they used to wear Wellingtons because they did all
that. Yeah, because he started in the Derek, the old John Radcliffe, in the observatory. He used to carry these
corridor.
Sheep,
yes.
Yeah, up this spiral staircase. And then they built this building for him here. And then for some reason the university, I think it was going through another period of financial depression anyway, it said that they couldn't afford to, when he retired, they couldn't afford to run a research building, and they were going to just shut it down. And so I suggested that we should try and develop a building with a, where this type of work should be done, with a strong accent really on training, not making it too rigid in its kind of research direction, just using this technology. And went to the MRC and James Gowans was running the MRC at that time, and he was very enthusiastic about this, but the MRC didn't have quite enough money. So they put in some money, and then we went to Wolfson and he put in some money, and the university put in a tiny amount. And then we'd set up a two-story building, and then right at the last minute, Bodmer, who was head of the Imperial Cancer Research Fund at that time, came along and said they'd like a bit of it. So they put in some money in the third floor. And so that's how it all started. But I think the, come back to the medical school, I think the other interesting things that happened is we started this graduate program, didn't we, during my last years. And I think that's been probably fairly successful.
That's the graduate entry medicine,
yeah.
Course. Oh, yes. Yes.
In fact,
we had a lot of kind of worries about it at first, but.
It developed really very quickly and very successfully, and in fact quite a lot of the graduates now win the prize, so interesting that that's the case.
Yeah, I mean the big problem here was with the reforms, the GMC reforms, and they were obviously desperate for us to kind of, well, I'd say dilute the science a bit and make sure these kids were exposed to patients in day one and that type of thing. And it always seemed to me that medicine was such a diverse activity that there is a place for diversity in medical schools as well in the Oxford kind of first degree and strong base in science, they shouldn't really dilute it. We had some interesting
discussions
with those early site visits, I remember. But I think we managed to compromise with them in the end. They were in danger of closing the place. But,
And now, of course, it's expanded to a certain extent, although it's not a large medical school.
Right.
About 160 in each year, of which 30 are graduate entry. And that balance might shift if it was thought to be a good idea.
Yeah.
But the final honours school element of it, I think, is still recognised as being very important by the GMC.
Well, it's fairly unique, isn't it, really?
Yes.
I mean, I'm on the external review board for Harvard Medical School. I was there last week, in a sense, a lot of their, nearly all their students come in with a first degree anyway. And in that sense, it's rather similar to here, but I think it would have been a tragedy to lose that. And then, of course, the other thing that happened, as the research base strengthened here, it expanded a lot. It expanded hugely, really, in the later years. I think all in all, it's a fairly successful school, isn't it?
I think the medical sciences division is as big as the whole of Imperial College.
Yeah.
Right. It's the size of a school, not just a small university.
It was funny, because when I first came here, there was absolutely no kind of interplay with Parks Road. I mean, they thought we were complete idiots at first. And told us so.
We do the science and you do that clinical bit.
Yeah, that's right. Was amazing. But it was the same. That wasn't unique to Oxford. I mean, when I came back to Liverpool from Johns Hopkins, they had no teaching in haematology there. The wonderful professor of physiology at Liverpool called Gregory, a man who discovered gastrin and all that. And he asked me if I would give some lectures in the physiology course in the blood. But he told his people who didn't really trust these doctors. So apparently he had all my first lectures taped, and they had to have a kind of feedback session on them to see if I was suitable.
And have a sort of scientific imprimatur.
But if it's that atmosphere right across the country, I mean, the division between the kind of science, basic sciences, and I think it's improved a lot.
Well, it's interesting reading Flexner 100 years on to see how that, to what extent we have held on to that in England as well as in the States.
Yeah.
And comparing it with Europe is quite interesting, I think, too, because the German students that come to us, whether they're elective students or whether they're native Germans who come for the whole course, say that the clinical aspect, the immersion in clinical medicine here is much greater than when you get in Germany.
I think the clinical aspects are better here than in the States as well.
That's interesting. Certainly when our elective students go to major institutions, they come back with glowing reports, many of them, on their clinical skills and clinical involvement with patients. So that must be a cause for satisfaction to think that the bedside end of the bench to bedside is flourishing, and the bench end too, hopefully.
What we're preparing them for, though, in the future is another matter, isn't it? Well, I told you, didn't I, that about 30% of the year at Harvard are doing the master's course in Harvard Business School at the same time.
Interesting.
And when I might have breakfast with them, always when I'm at these meetings, and I thought it was because they were all going to be administrators or something, but no, they said that you can't practice medicine in the States, you know, without having some proper training in business management. And that's terribly depressing.
And is that so that they can go out and set up their own institutions and fundraise and become independent of whatever?
Well, to some degree, yeah. They're very proud at Harvard now. They've got a primary care, they've built up a new primary care center. But in fact, I don't know, it's a kind of, a lot, just a big extension of their kind of office medicine. And there are no real, the concept of the family doctor is non-existent, really. Mind you, it's not far off here in time.
The grip is tightening.
But no, they're just kind of generalists who work in offices, and they call that primary care. But it doesn't seem to me to be.
Not the same as general practice.
No. And just the last thing, really, is are there any particular projects happening in this institute that I could talk about?
In the institute?
Yes, here. What are some of the projects going on here?
There's a kind of mixture, really. My old group, when I retired, the MRC kept our unit going under Douglas Higgs. And
that's the molecular hematology.
And they are less kind of clinically orientated than I was. But their major goals are to try to understand how how the elements of the blood are formed, and the kind of regulatory mechanisms in the formation of blood, and that is being applied to certain forms of malignant disease of the blood as well by some of the groups there. I think the genetics group with Andrew Wilkie has been extremely strong as well, and they're continuing to try to understand the and have made major progress in understanding the genetic basis for some facial deformities in children.
Yeah.
I think they're probably as good as anybody in the world in that field.
Yeah.
Very, very good, and they've made quite a lot of progress. And then they've still got quite a strong cancer group up here, and working in various aspects of cancer. Then the immunology group, because the Andrew McMichael took over from me as director of the institute, and his group's been and still is very much involved in working in AIDS and HIV and they've done a lot of the really important fundamental work on understanding how HIV kind of wrecks your immune system. And in fact, it was there was a review in Science last year, and I was amazed to see that the group in here had the highest citation index in HIV and anyone even more than all these big American groups. Yeah.
Might that be related to work that they've done abroad, looking at things that have cropped up outside the European area, things in Africa?
Oh, I think so, yeah. And particularly the relationship of HIV to tuberculosis in Africa as well, yeah.
That's interesting. That's less, it is more global than looking outwards. That's perhaps one of the strengths.
Yeah.
Because of the relationship to peripheral units based in those countries.
That's that's also been the same, because we have a very strong parasitology group in here as well, with Chris Newbold, and they've linked up with Cambridge a lot recently to doing these big mapping genomes of all sorts of organisms. But they kind of formed the laboratory backup for the tropical units particularly in Thailand and Kenya. And there's also some very interesting work going on in the iron field, and particularly relating to malaria as well. Because iron deficiency is a huge problem in the developing countries, as you know, and but coexistent malaria makes it really very complicated to kind of manage iron deficiency, and they've been involved in some very, I think, quite important work suggesting that the body's response to malaria makes it disencourages iron absorption, and it's a bad time. What you really need to do with these children now in the developing country is modify your periods of iron replacement to the low malarial transmission seasons and so on, to get some this type of thing, anyway, from a practical point of view, very important. So those are just a few
things.
Yes.
I think those are all my sort of particular questions. Can you think of anything else?
I think the idea is very appealing, that Oxford has, in general, looked outwards in its endeavour, both scientifically and clinically. And I would see your role in bringing together the clinical and scientific, in setting up units such as the ones in Sri Lanka and the ones in Thailand, as being a very important element. Because there's a sort of combination of rigour, but also an understanding of what's possible, both within, and I suppose if you have a good cadre of people who are clinically very well trained, then you're more likely to get good results for the amount of money that you spend. Whereas if the clinical underpinning is lax, it's much less.
Yeah, I think the financial side of this is really very important. I'm trying to get this message over to government. In fact, maybe they're slowly getting it, but if you form these partnerships, you do have control over it. It's rather different than throwing aid into a country and throwing aid at foreign governments. I know what happens to a lot of that in the places I work. And you do have some control over the situation with a genuine partnership. And you can control the kind of cash flow and all that. But they've done extremely well. I mean, Pink White's done wonderfully well in Asia with his malaria programs.
And he's coming back to give the second Weatherall lecture in May.
That's right. Yeah,
so we'll be delighted if you're able to come to that.
In the diary, well.
And the other fascinating one is tuberculosis, because as Rosie was mentioning, that TB was an important component in Osler's time, and yet it's a hugely important. And it's only, I feel that it's sort of knocking at the door in the UK, because seeing some of the cases in relation to my own HIV work in London, you can see the impact of tuberculosis in people who are very, very sick, and the interplay of that with malaria, with HIV, with and population level. I think that's a very fascinating story.
Yeah, the vaccine programs here I haven't seen the latest reports of Adrian.
Adrian and Helen McShane, I think. I think they're going into next stage of trials, so they will be going into human. They've done some early work, I think.
They've gone into human with the malaria vaccines.
And I think it started with TB.
And with TB,
It's promising. Early days, but I think they're beyond the animal stage.
Yeah. Well, there was all this noise made about the malaria vaccine last year. But, I know. The Guardian had a piece about this meeting where this was all announced, saying the scientists were in tears and all that. It's absolute rubbish, really. This thing has given partial protection for up to about 6 months. And it's rather early days. It's been a huge problem. I don't know if there's anything else to say about the Oxford Medical School.
There's the one very amusing story that you always tell about your appointment. I don't know whether you want to go on record with that.
Oh,
the fact that you had to contact them.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, it really was a bizarre setup. I got an invitation to come down here and talk about this job. Then I went back to Liverpool. It was all a big setup, actually. I mean, it's probably not publishable anyway. Because Richard Doll had offered this job, both medicine and surgery, more or less without telling anybody, and they got a bit cross, and so they wanted to have a quick look at a few other people, and I was invited down. I knew nothing about Oxford at all. I'd only been here once on a kind of day trip with my parents when I was a kid, but. So about a week after I'd been down here, I got this phone call saying you were unanimously elected Nuffield Professor of Clinical Medicine. Please give us an answer in 24 hours. So I did chat with my mates in Liverpool and decided they didn't seem to be the better ones I would need to bring this research group, not averse to moving. So I said okay, and they said that it was well in advance because I wouldn't be taking it up for 18 months, but we're building the John Radcliffe Hospital, and you might have some say in what they're doing. Anyway, I literally did not hear anything for a year. And then I thought, I've got to,
to make some plans.
Tell the Chancellor or the Vice Chancellor of Liverpool that I might be leaving him. And so I contacted his office, and he said he knew Oxford. He said, but don't worry, if it's all a mistake, you better find out. He said, if it's all a mistake, we'll keep a place for you here. So I didn't have the courage to ring them. I got my dear little secretary, old lady, Mrs. Cogley, and I said, ring them up and ask them, will you? And she came back from the phone. She's such a dear old character, but a real Liverpool. She was away ages, and when she came back, she said, you can't go to her. I said, why? What did they say? Well, I said to them, you thought you'd been appointed, but you weren't sure, and you had nothing from them. And there was a long silence, and then this funny posh woman came on the phone, and she says, what does he want? It was announced in the Times, wasn't it? What more does he want? I never had anything on paper.
No.
Or with the Regis chair.
No. Oh, I see.
Oh, the only thing with the Regis chair was just this letter from Margaret Thatcher or from her office saying,
yes,
I have it in mind to... It's written in that kind of language. Which,
yes.
I have it in mind to put your name forward to the Queen, as though it would be quite easy for her to not have it in mind.
And again, nothing from the Prime Minister's office or the university or from indeed from Buckingham Palace.
Not a thing. So there's no record I was ever here.
So there's been at least two times in your life where you've taken a deep breath and just gone or come or arrived and found that you were greeted with open arms, as it were, rather than open mouth, as we say proverbially.
I wouldn't say open arms. My first greeting in walking up that awful long corridor in the John Radcliffe,
in the Radcliffe Infirmary,
was the little man running out at me. I think I told you that. I turned right into the MDM, and this little old man rushed out and said, you must be Petherall. So I said, Putin denying it. So he said, your predecessor gave me space in the department when I retired. Can I assume you're not going to take it off me? And I, God, first morning, I didn't want to kind of offend the old guy, so I said, well, I'm sure we can arrange something, not realising I'd just given away half my research paper. Oh, good, he said, and stamped off down the corridor, and then he turned round and he said, oh, by the way, I should have introduced myself, my name's Hans Krebs.
And so indeed, I remember his laboratory on the first floor.
Yeah, that's right.
Funny story.
Yeah, and his son told me later that he was desperately worried about me coming in case I...
out on his ear.
Out on his ear, yeah.
Oh, dear.
Fascinating.
It is fascinating.
Yes, it is.
Well, the old boy was latterly not really doing very much, but he had this huge work ethos. He had to be in the lab on Saturdays and Sundays. And In the end, they were running a rotor to keep him company.
Yes, that's true, actually. I remember coming to the NDM corridor on weekends on and going up to the wards, and there was always something going on in the lab, in that little lab with lots of glassware.
That's right.
Yes. No, that's absolutely right. Yeah. There's always somebody there.
Yes.
Yes. Hey ho. And all of that now completely not there at all.
No.
Strange.
Yes, it is. When you think of all the famous people who walked up and down those corridors.
Yes, and all the people who were looked after and cared for, all the dramas of people's training and teaching careers. Mm. Lots of that happened. Fascinating.
Yes.
Well, you've got what you need.
I have. It's been very helpful.